got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's going on? How are you?
I am very excited about today. I've been looking forward to this one for a very long time, longer than we've had it on the schedule, because I knew that the work that we will discuss has been in the brew, and I'm very glad to see it have the light of day and that we have a guest to discuss it. So real good stuff.
Yeah. I'm excited to get into it as well. And to clue everybody into the secret, we're going to be talking about the weed killer glyphosate, which we've talked about before, of course. And specifically, we've discussed the fact that there's really no evidence that it causes cancer, though there's still a big controversy around that. And there appears every so often a new study or a new review in a science journal that purports to show that there's evidence that glyphosate causes cancer. So with us today, we have a cancer epidemiologist, and he's been on both our shows actually a couple times now. We've got Jeffrey Cabot with us. And Jeffrey, why don't you take a minute and just introduce yourself to the audience for people who haven't heard you on a podcast before or haven't read any of your work.
Okay. My name is Jeffrey Cabot, and I'm a cancer epidemiologist. I've been on the faculty of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and Stony Brook School of Medicine, and I've done research for 40 years on a whole range of risk factors for mainly for cancer, but also for heart disease, from smoking to alcohol and diet and hormones and electromagnetic fields and so on. So one characteristic of my career has been that I've done a lot of primary research into questions of what are important causes of various cancers. But about 20 years ago, I decided that much of the work that we do as cancer epidemiologists tends to get badly distorted. So I took up a second line of work, which was writing for the general public about what's really going on with studies of, say, DDT or cell phones or whatever, and trying to strip out the exaggerations or the blinkering of the story that they were telling and assess how strong really is the evidence. So that's my sideline.
But you've written a few books on the subjects of risk, and what was the most recent one that you had recently completed?
It's called Getting Risk Right, and it came out in end of 2016, and it deals with the whole question of how this research can be done in a way that really yields new knowledge on the one hand, and it gives several in-depth examples of that, and on the other hand, how it can really be much ado about nothing and can lead to exaggerations or distortions of how important a given risk factor really is.
All right. Very, very cool stuff. And I want to dive into the paper that you wrote or co-authored that we're going to talk about. But Kevin, just for anyone who hasn't really clued into this glyphosate controversy, maybe they're listening to this podcast for the first time. What's the issue? Why is this weed killer a concern for so many people?
Well, glyphosate is a really interesting molecule. Some people have described it as an herbicide, a once-in-a-century herbicide. And it's because it's non-specific. It seems to, or non-selective. It seems to affect just about every plant it touches. And the beautiful part about glyphosate is it's relatively low toxicity. It has relatively low toxicity to animals. It has a good environmental turnover. It's broken down by microbes in the soil. So in a way, this was really looked at as a miracle compound. However, this was the compound that was used in the design of genetically engineered crops to resist glyphosate. So in other words, you could put in a gene from Agrobacterium that would not be affected by the herbicide and would allow the plants to grow through the presence of the herbicide. This is a really great technology. It saved farmers lots of money. It changed us to no-till or low-till farming, saved farmers lots of money, eventually resulting in lower consumer prices. Yet because it was involved in genetically engineered crops, it became the target of activists. And the story we're following up on here today is, if you want to target, they spent 25, 30 years trying to target the crops, and it didn't really work. So if you want to get to the consumer, talk about the chemistry and convince the consumer that the chemistry is the problem. It's a lot easier, you know, road to hoe there. It's pretty road to hoe. It's pretty easy to do that. You can scare the consumer pretty easily with chemistry. So they essentially made up this story of glyphosate causing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma based on some very cursory data, and ultimately resulted in, you know, the Bayer lawsuits for billions of dollars. One of the key players in this story was the meta-analysis we'll talk about today, which was used in the court. It was discussed widely in the media, and maybe doesn't hold as much water as people gave it. So that's it in a nutshell.
So Jeffrey, with that, can you introduce us to the study that Kevin just mentioned and why it was so incendiary when it came out? It got a ton of press in a way that a lot of epidemiological research doesn't. So what did they find, and give us just sort of a reader's digest of what the study was, and then let's go into your response to this work.
Okay. The study came out in February of 2019, and I'll refer to it as the Zhang study because that's the name of the first author on the paper. And this study was done by very qualified epidemiologists at foremost universities, Mount Sinai, University of Washington, and UC Berkeley, among others. So that gave it the look of very respectable science. And what the authors did was they said, we want to examine all existing studies that looked at exposure to glyphosate in relation to the development of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And what they found, so there are studies where they use crops that are grown to infer whether glyphosate was used, but they didn't. They wanted studies where they asked the respondents, the subjects in the studies, directly whether they had used glyphosate and other pesticides. So that limited them to five studies. Limited to six studies. Among those six, there was one study, and I need to tell you the name of it. It's called the Agricultural Health Study, and it was a very large 20-year study of about 54,000 farmers in Nebraska and Iowa. So that is a really what I would call a Cadillac study. In addition, the other five studies were case control studies. They were smaller, and they have various problems that we can go into. But what they did was to combine these individual studies into what's called a meta-analysis. And I'll give you a very brief description of what meta-analysis is. It's simply combining a number of small studies in order to try to summarize them, or you could think of it as taking a weighted average of the results, the numeric results of the individual studies, to get a more, hopefully, a more stable estimate of what is the effect of glyphosate exposure on the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Okay, so now, what did they find? Because my understanding, and then Kevin can weigh in here too, being the agricultural scientist, my understanding is the vast majority of research that's been done on this chemical shows that the risk of cancer it poses is minimal. There's really no reason to be concerned about it. But this meta-analysis sort of went to a counter-consensus conclusion. So tell us about that.
Okay. First, maybe I should say something about meta-analysis and especially what are the guidelines for conducting a meta-analysis. That's a key issue here. Okay? So if you're combining studies, different studies, in order to get what we call a summary estimate, so an overall risk estimate, you need to pay attention to the quality of the data in the individual studies. And there's a manual called the Cochrane Manual from the Cochrane collaboration in the UK. And that's sort of the Bible for statistics in the area of health and clinical trials. And they emphasize that in order to do a valid meta-analysis, you can't have great differences in quality between the studies you're comparing. And that's where the Zhang meta-analysis, in my view, ran into trouble. And we can talk about what that trouble consists in.
So what were some of the issues? You mentioned that, you know, if you combine a bunch of studies that aren't more or less equitable, you're going to get a skewed result. So what sort of issues does that present when they try to put all of this research together?
The large and prospective agricultural health study, as I said, enrolled a large number of their pesticide applicators that they followed for a period of 20 years. And what they did was they asked them at the outset, this was in the mid-90s, they asked them about their use of different pesticides. And they collected a whole range of information. And this allowed them to, there were 49 pesticides that they asked them about, and one of them was glyphosate. Now, this allowed them the large numbers, the fact that after 20 years, this cohort developed somewhere on the maybe 5,000 cases, maybe slightly more. And among those cancers, there were every imaginable cancer, but they had 575 cases of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is impressive because non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is quite rare. And what these numbers and this detailed information allowed them to do was to look at exposure to glyphosate in a rather detailed way. That is, and before I mention that, the other point that distinguishes this study, or one of the points that distinguishes it, is that over 80% of the cohort, 80% of these pesticide applicators had used glyphosate. So that's a help if you're interested in what are the effects of glyphosate. And that's not true in the other studies. So this detailed data allowed them to look at exposure in detail. So they divided everyone in the cohort into five different levels. And they are people with no exposure to glyphosate over the period, and then into four so-called quartiles. So the lowest level of exposure to glyphosate, then the second lowest, then the third lowest, and the highest group. So that's one of the key points to in the discussion that we're having. So this study, the agricultural health study, published a paper. These are researchers at the National Cancer Institute, published a paper on the effects of glyphosate, and they looked at over 20 cancers. And those cancers included colon and breast and prostate and so on, and also what are called lymphatic or lymphopoietic cancers, including leukemia and lymphomas. And they looked at individual types of lymphoma, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So their finding was that glyphosate use was not associated in the slightest with any of the cancers they examined, okay? Not at the highest level, not for lower exposures. There were no associations, which is quite striking, with exposure to glyphosate. So we can pause there and go on from there. That's a key point for understanding what the Zhang and company did in their meta-analysis.
So they took what seems to be a really high quality study and then they combined it with several smaller studies, and the result was dramatic. What was the increased risk that they attributed to glyphosate exposure in this meta-analysis?
Okay. The punchline that they included in their abstract was they found that when they combined all six studies, that overall people with exposure to glyphosate had a 41% increased risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Okay. And they put this in their abstract, highlighting it, emphasizing it, and they went on to conclude that this finding amounts to compelling evidence that glyphosate exposure is associated with the developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Okay, so in your response, which was just published just this week, I believe,
right.
You highlighted, and the article is very technical and very methodical, which it should be for the kind of publication it is, but you make a handful of key points that you argue point to the limitations of this meta-analysis we're describing. So let's go into those. And I think probably one of the most important ones is this 20-year lag effect that you discussed. So first of all, what's a lag effect and how does it relate to the results of this meta-analysis that were splashed across all the headlines? I mean, CNN, Reuters, everybody from my recollection covered this study. So let's talk about that primary issue first.
Okay. Since that's fine, since we're on the agricultural health study, and then we'll have to talk about the other studies that they blended, combined it with, and that'll complete the picture. Well, the Zhang In the original paper, and then there's been a second paper that just came out, they emphasize that they were guided by an a priori hypothesis, and they hammer away at this as if this is some sort of incantation. And their a priori hypothesis is first that those with the highest exposure to glyphosate should exhibit the highest risk, okay? Which makes sense, okay? Then as to the point about latency, that was the second parameter that they were interested in and used to select a relative risk from the Ag Health study. Latency simply refers to the period of time between first exposure to a compound and the ultimate diagnosis of the cancer that we're talking about. So because the agricultural health study went into such detail, they published, they looked at their data in a number of ways, and their main result, and this needs to be emphasized, their main result was not having any lag, which means that you're looking at exposure, but not specifying a time period between first exposure and the development of disease. And that's what one sees most of the time when one looks at these kinds of studies. And that was the result that they highlighted in their results section. And that was the first result that they gave for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And let me tell you that there, since we'll get into the numbers a tiny bit, there what they found was no association, but the actual number was, on average, was about 0.85. So it was below one. So if you're doing a meta-analysis and there are five different results for exposure, one would expect the people doing the meta-analysis to acknowledge that there are these five different exposures. But that's not what these five different risk estimates. That's not what Zhang and company did. What they did was they decided that people with the longest latency, implying the longest exposure and longest time to develop cancer, that they should have the highest risk. And two things about that point. So there was no latency period. There was 5-year latency. There was 10-year latency. There was 15-year latency and 20-year latency. They picked 20-year latency, and they justified this by citing a paper. Unfortunately, we don't know definitively what the latency period is for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but the paper that they cited to justify using a long latency period, unfortunately, was a paper that didn't provide data. They hypothesized that benzene exposure was associated with increased risk of leukemia. Now, leukemia is different from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it appears that their justification for picking this 20-year lag or 20-year latency risk is pretty shaky. And in fact, the CDC came out with an in-depth consideration of the latency period for different cancers, and they concluded that for lymphomas in general, for lymphomas, the latency period is between 2 and 20 years. And we also know that one other fact about relevant to the latency for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is that people with immune deficiencies tend to develop to be at greater risk of lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there the latency period is also short, tends to be short, under 10 years. So the question is, so what was the justification for picking this one number out of five numbers? It doesn't seem to be supported by the literature, but it needs to be pointed out that for the highest quartile, in other words, the highest level of exposure for which we had these five different latency analyses, the 20-year latency period had the highest numeric value. It wasn't very high. It was 1.12, so not much above one. But that makes a big difference because it's a large study. When you enter all the numbers from the different studies into the program, that makes a big difference whether you're entering 1.12 or whether you're entering 0.85, which was the unlagged analysis and the value that one would have expected someone to use.
Yeah, just to add to that, Jeffrey, you know, we had discussed before, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is not one thing. Now, this is a spectrum of different cancers which fall into the category of relatively rare cancers that fall into the category of non-Hodgkin's. It's kind of like non-dairy creamer. It doesn't tell you what it is. It says what it's not. And each one of those cancers would be expected to have a different etiology, different lag time. And you would see, if this was a real association, you would see a much more specific trend with specific cancer subtypes. And I think it would be really easy to pick out based on the huge numbers of users that are there and the fact that this is a relatively rare cancer. So this is what really, you know, brings it to my mind. It seems like taking the data and the time points and the dosages that fit together best. And I don't mean to cast, you know, aspersions on their motivations here, but any of the other time points that would have been used, any of the other data that would have been used, wouldn't have given this outcome and wouldn't have resulted in this massive media blitz that connected the compound to the cancer. And so when we hear you talk about it, it just reinforces that it just doesn't fit that this would be the basis for all of the fallout around glyphosate.
Right. Well, you made a really good point. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the occurrence is about 20 cases per 100,000. And interestingly, over the past two decades, the best data from the National Cancer Institute shows that rate, that incidence rate for the occurrence of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has not changed. It's been quite flat over this time period. Interestingly, because it's during the past 20 years, glyphosate spraying has gone up by a factor of 15-fold or more. But the rareness of it speaks to the issue of what you can do in an epidemiologic study, okay? Because if something is that rare, as I said, in following 54,000 pesticide applicators for 20 years, over that time period, 575 cases were identified in that cohort. Okay, in the case control studies, which now we have to turn to them because we know one number that was entered in the meta-analysis, that is 1.12, a very modest number and not statistically significant. But we have to look at the case control studies, the five other studies, and what they contributed to the meta-analysis and address the question, of, well, how does the quality of case control studies compare to this large prospective study?
So could you remind us again as to why they chose to not include all of the other data that were not consistent with the hypothesis that glyphosate causes NHL?
Just explain to me what specifically you're referring to. I'm going to talk about Hardell and Erickson and DeRoos and so forth. I want to make some basic points about the five other studies that were thrown into the meta-analysis, because that speaks to what you get when you combine these studies and why carrying out this meta-analysis is something that has to be done with great care, and concluding, drawing conclusions from this exercise, as we conclude in our paper, is really taxes one's critical faculties to say, well, what is the use of this meta-analysis? But can I go on just to make a few points about the case control studies, and then you can ask me your questions?
No, sure. Go ahead. Dive in and go ahead with that.
Okay. So the case control studies are from different countries. One's from Canada. One's from the United States. And two are from Sweden, and one is from France. But one important point to realize about case control studies is you're asking people who have already developed a disease about their behaviors and their exposures, and this leaves you open to the possibility of what's called recall bias, and that is that people with a cancer, when you ask them if they're about their exposures, they may be more likely to remember certain things relevant to their exposures or to emphasize certain exposures and maybe highball them, because everyone wants to know why they developed a rare cancer. So we have critical analyses that show us that in a case control study of glyphosate, and this is from the EPA and it's from another group, they've looked at the responses to a whole range of pesticides, and what they show is that in a number of the case control studies, at least three, maybe four of the five case control studies, there are indications that that you're getting responses that are due to bias. In other words, when they're asked that question, they tend to respond yes about their exposure. And what this leads to is that on average, the case control studies show what we call an odds ratio, it's the equivalent to a relative risk, of about 2 or so. That's not true for one of the studies, which shows very small study, which shows no change in risk. It's a relative risk of 1, odds ratio of 1. But on average, the results of the case control studies are higher. And so when you combine the six studies in a meta-analysis, as I said, it makes a big difference whether the very weighty, because of its size, agricultural health study, whether you select the 1.12 for the 20-year latency or the first relative risk that they present of 0.85, and they're in that vicinity. So those are the mechanics of how they came out with this result of a 41% increase that got all this attention. And I really think it's important to understand that, although it's sort of involved. Another point to your point, Kevin, is that since non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is such a rare disease, you have very small numbers of cases in the typical case control study in a single location, and that's why they don't have the ability to look at subsets of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But you make a really good point that it's sort of a grab bag term. It's a mixed bag of diagnoses, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
So trying to sum up what we've talked about thus far, Jeffrey, can you tell us what can we glean from this meta-analysis, if anything? Because as a layman, what I'm hearing you say is the result that they reached required some very careful statistical footwork. And if they had changed a few variables or maybe even one variable, the result wouldn't have been the same. So I'm wondering, am I on course there, or am I off base to suggest that maybe the study isn't especially useful?
You're exactly on target, and I'm trying to be. I've been looking at the study for the past almost 2 years now, and we tried to do take a different approach and to looking at all of the different numbers and all of the papers and seeing which estimates were the best justified. In other words, where people showed that there's bias in the case control studies, maybe they gave a number of different estimates, and to try to take the one that seemed the most, the best supported, the least subject to bias. And that's what we did. And in our paper, I haven't mentioned this, we come up with the result that that in essence, there's no association between exposure to glyphosate and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And instead of a 41% increase, which is, it's got to be said, was just barely statistically significant, we come up with a summary estimate of 1.05, and that's really not different from one. So what we concluded after looking at all of these different numbers and what they represent, what we concluded is that comparing, throwing together in the hopper studies that are so heterogeneous, so which the Cochrane report cautions against doing, that are so different in quality and so different in the detail that's available, not warranted. Is that the throwing in these five case control studies of greatly inferior quality is, rather than adding to your ability to make a firm judgment about this question, what it really does, it dilutes the very the higher quality data in the prospective study, in the agricultural health study. So this is an instance in which I believe meta-analysis before plunging into conducting this meta-analysis, I believe that the researchers should have taken a good look at what it is they were combining, and that they should have thought twice about it.
So is there a trend more broadly in epidemiology of studies like this, which sounds like this one is relatively low quality? Is this a broader trend in the field, or is this maybe just a one-off example where the authors of the paper just got a little ahead of themselves?
Okay. I think this is not evidence of an increasing trend. I can't really say. What I can say is that there are always papers that draw attention to results that when you look carefully, there's less that meets the eye than you might think at first glance. There are a lot of different comments to make, but this is why I wrote my first book, which came out in 2008, and I was involved in studies of exposure to power lines and other sources of electromagnetic fields. And do these fields increase the risk of breast cancer? We were out on Long Island then and at Stony Brook, and this was a question of tremendous interest. Also, the question about does exposure to DDT in food and water, does that increase the risk of breast cancer? And that's what really seeing the results that were published, and we were publishing on those questions, trying to do the best studies we could do, and seeing how the message was getting out to the public made me feel, wait a second, I got to weigh in on how people should be reading these studies. So there are always studies that take something and by not putting it in the proper perspective or by doing maybe an inadequate statistical analysis, come up with a sexy result, a result that's going to grab attention and grab headlines and is going to require, you know, will generate more studies being conducted. And hopefully at the end of the process, you finally come to a more stable idea of how important is this, is this risk. And that happened with electromagnetic fields, that happened with DDT, and what at the outset appeared to be some great threat turned out to be something that was barely distinguishable from noise.
So that brings me to my last question. And then maybe Kevin has something else he wants to ask you, but I'm just really curious, especially in the post-COVID era that we're living in, how does this kind of research impact the public's understanding of science? Because as you just said, you can get a sexy result, it gets up in the headlines, people start seeing it in their news feeds, and it really influences their thinking, or it changes their perspective about a chemical or cell phone radiation or what have you, or an infectious disease, whatever it is. So what is the impact of these sorts of studies that have questionable results? You know, maybe they're worth publishing, and you know, the scientific community should debate these things, maybe behind closed doors or in peer-reviewed journals, but they get out. And then the public starts weighing in on them. So what's the effect of that?
I think that over really looking back 30 years, and we're producing more and more epidemiologists, and epidemiologists have to publish, and there are new questions that arise, and there's a lot of good epidemiology. But I would say that in the area of environmental epidemiology and exposure to chemicals. Of course, chemicals are all around us. We're made up of chemicals. But that has a particular resonance for the public when you bring up a chemical or radiation or something like that. And I think that it has a harmful effect because we all are looking out for things that are going to do us in. But this, the publication of so many studies, and we're talking hundreds of thousands of epidemiologic studies, not all of them, by far a minority of them latching on to something like this that makes a good headline. But I think this is makes the public feel that everything is bad for you, which is not true, and makes them feel that maybe it's not worthwhile worrying about the pounds that they're putting on or smoking or drinking excessively or not going for vaccines because it seems that everything around us is harmful.
Yeah, I think I once saw a study that said literally every food can cause and prevent cancer.
You did. And the study was by a guy at Harvard and John Ioannidis, and it showed a nice graph, which on to the left of the center, it had all 50 different foods taken from cookbooks, and sugar and salt and fat and on and on and on. And to the left and the right of this midline, it showed things that the same thing, milk, for example, or cheese, could cause cancer and at the same time could be protective against cancer.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you just can't win. So tell people where they can learn more about your work. So we said your latest book is Getting Risk Right. Tell us what your website is, what your Twitter handle is, because I think of all the topics that we cover on this podcast, this is probably one of the most important because it's the most practical in terms of the decisions that we make about what we eat and the things we're exposed to. So tell people where they can follow you and learn more about this.
Okay. It's very easy. My website is Jeffrey Cabot, all one word. So GeoffreyKabat.com. And there I have some of the most recent, maybe some of the most timely papers and journalistic writings. And then if you go into the individual pages, there are links to, I've written about 90 or 100 articles about various putative risks and what to make of them. These were on Forbes and Slate and other outlets. And there are links to all of those articles. And there are descriptions, there are links to the books and comments about the books and so forth. So jeffreycabot.com is one place. And then I write occasionally on Twitter. I can't keep up with Twitter. I find it scary in one way, but very valuable to follow enormously worthwhile people on Twitter. And there it's Geo, so the first three letters of my first name, Geo Cabot at Twitter. So that's it.
Excellent stuff. Well, be sure to follow Jeffrey, because for as much as you hate Twitter, I think you post some insightful stuff pretty frequently. So so check him out, and then follow Kevin and I as well. It's at Cam J English and at Kevin Folta. And while we're at it, and since we've been telling you about people we follow, I want to give you one other scientist who I follow on Twitter. His name's Josh Bloom. He's a chemist with the American Council on Science and Health. And his handle is at Josh Bloom, ACSH. If you want to understand the epidemic and you want to understand the chemical side of food safety, Josh covers this in great detail. And he's funny, too. It's rare to find a scientist who's a great communicator. Jeffrey's one. I think Josh is another great example. So check him out. And we will be be back next week with another show. And in the meantime, if you guys want to help support us, help us improve the production quality of the show and get it out to more people, send us a donation. There's a little button at the bottom of each episode. Send us a buck or $5, and it goes a long way. So thank you very much, and we will see you next time.